Hey, here we are for another episode of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the news, opinion, and answers that you want to know. And by the way, we're supported by no one. We're beholden to no one. And so what we give you is the unvarnished truth, the straight talk. This is basically an unscripted program, so you're not going to hear really smooth, polished, kind of BS that you're going to hear on other places. And we're not afraid to call out misinformation that we hear, read, or see on other media. So let's get down to it. First of all, happy 4th of July to everyone. We live in the greatest place on the earth. And the only sadness that comes with the 4th of July is the fact that some states just aren't as free as others. And the restrictive gun control laws and onerous tax laws are definitely an indication of that. But I was really happy to see the national parade that was presided over by President Donald J. Trump. I thought it made our military look great. It made just our country look great. I mean, it wasn't jingoistic. It wasn't anything but a celebration of, the small percentage of people who fought, actively supported the revolution and ousted a colonial government that was not looking out for the people and started, the greatest experiment on earth in democracy. In other news, the NRA Institute for Legislative Action has an interim chief. And if I mispronounce this, this is strictly on me because I've only seen it written. Jaysev Ouimet, Ouimet, I guess that's Ouimet. From all indications and just reading what Willis Lee has read about it or written about him, sounds like a great guy, sounds like somebody that everybody likes and can work with, and hopefully he will go back towards mending some of this problems that have happened over the last couple of months with the NRA. So we wish him well and hope that he does a great job, and looking forward to him having a big impact, because we got some big legislative and electoral challenges are looming right around the corner, just right around the corner. Okay, great. Well, we're going to start. Got a lot of stuff today related. Everything's related to ARs, basically. And it starts with the firearms news. Firearms news is the modern iteration of what used to be called shotgun news, which if you were back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even the early 2000s, that was the source where you got parts, guns, anything kind of mil-serp, anything shooting related. I mean, it was the place to be. And in many ways, it still is. I still pick them up, and I enjoy reading the ads. If you remember back in the 90s, IMA, International Military Antiques, used to have really comical cartoon drawings for the stuff that they were selling, and those were always pretty entertaining. But, they still have the large advertisers there in there. They've concentrated more. It used to be they really just had, goods and services advertised. It wasn't the articles they have now, and they've kind of gone into the articles. The articles are usually, pretty reasonably good quality. I like them, and especially when it's about guns I don't know very much about. The latest issue has got one on the FNC 556, a gun which I shot. It was a Swedish military rifle I shot. I liked it. I mean, again, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not really an M16 either. So, nothing really wrong with it. The Beretta AR-70, another 5.56, which was, I think, for a while used by the Italian Army, may even still be so. Another excellent kind of gun. Both those were kind of, developed and are much more akin to the AR-180 system than they are the M16. So they're good rifles. But in a world dominated by the AR-15 M16, they offer no real advantage over it. Although they are good solid designs, but they're just never going to be made at a price point or distributed or proliferated enough to ever kind of take over the market. The other rifle they did was the SIG PE-57, a very high-end, old-school manufactured, lot of machining, and the stocks are wood on it. 1950s machining, done to a very, very high standard for 7.5 Swiss. Those were excellent rifles, and they actually made a little later versions that they imported into the United States, the SIG AMT, which was a later development in 7.62 NATO. And those things go for a fortune now. They're 14. I take that back, not 14. I think they run, if you can find them, from $5,000 to probably $8,000. You know, that's a lot when you can buy, good functional 7.62 NATO rifles for, a lot less, for under $1,000. You can get one. Those have become collectors, the purview of collectors, both the earlier PE-57 and the SIG AMT. They're really, it's like a beautiful car from the 1950s, not something you're going to use every day, and certainly not something you're going to take out and use very, very hard. So very interesting articles indeed. And it's a really good issue. And I suggest that you pick it up if you have an interest in, the post-war and some post-war military rifles. Of course, the flagship article in this edition of the Firearms News is about something we talked about last podcast, which is the BRN, the Brownells AR Proto, BRN AR Proto. This is actually a modern incarnation and very, very well done version of the early AR-15. That's got some modern. It's essentially gotten a lot of modern features to it in the places where you really don't see. It's absolutely a great rifle. And starting from the furniture kind of moving in, it has Brownells, kind of the brown polymer furniture. Very durable, very serviceable. It's got heat shields inside, which was something that the Brownells AR-10 did not have initially. It's got those good, really interesting looking handguards. It's got, of course, the brown pistol grip we're all used to, the early style with no bump in it that came with the M16A2. And then it's got the early D model stock, which is no butt plate, or I'm sorry, it's got a butt plate, but it has no trap door in the butt, and it has a swivel, a swivel type sling swivel at the bottom, not the fixed one we're used to on the M16A1 and later rifles. So that's the furniture. Of course, it has the trigger cocking piece, which we'll talk about a little bit later. That's a great feature. It's got a lot of the good kind of markings and things that you would expect on the as a way to replicate the original ones. Brownells put a lot of effort into the details that you see, and markings, ridges, a non-captive fire takedown pin for the front of the receiver. All these things are very true to form of the original AR-15, and really, it's although it's modern made, you feel like you're holding a genuine piece of history in your hand, and it's a real pleasure. The internals and all that is modern AR-15. They didn't try to fut around and get the Edgewater buffer in there. That's the buffer system and spring and all the trigger stuff is modern AR-15. So you can, should something go wrong, you can swap those parts out. So that was really intelligent. They ship it with a 25 route straight magazine, which is unusual. And I'm going to test. I got my hands on one, so I'm gonna test that magazine. Because in-range TV was, you know, they were blathering about, well, it was a bad design, and when you replicate it, it still has the weaknesses of the whatever all that pablum was. We're going to test it and see if it actually does hold 25 rounds and function with 25 rounds, or if it is in fact a 23-round magazine and only functions reliably with 22, 23, or 24 rounds. We'll find that out and report that in another podcast. But anyway, it's an absolutely very interesting rifle. You know, it does have the weaknesses people ascribe to it. Are not weaknesses, but it does have some limitations. And the limitations, as I see it, are that, you know, there's no way to put any kind of optics on it. It does not have the hole in the center of what we call the carry handle, which is actually on this gun is the charging handle protector, because you can't have a nut or anything protruding below that, because we have the charging handle going back and forth when you're charging the rifle. It simply won't work. You have two things trying to occupy the same space. So there's no hole, there's no way to mount an optic on it. So you just have to kiss that goodbye. There's no way to put a gooseneck on it or any of the more modern mounting systems. I suppose if you really tried, you could get some sort of modern hand guards and put a rail on it and mount something forward. But, you know, what's the purpose of that? If you want to mount optics, you need a more modern AR. That's just the way it goes. And you can still use a retro model. You just have to go with one of the later retro models that has the T charging handle at the rear of the receiver and has the hole in the what is now the carrying handle on that version. And you can mount, you know, just like you would on any earlier AR. You know, any fixed carry handle AR. So you can do all that. But this rifle, you cannot. So you're going to run at iron sights. It's going to be an iron sight rifle, and that's the way it goes. So it's actually really a absolutely outstanding design. What I did was I put it, when I was examining it, I put it next to, and these are semi-automatic only, as to basically a stamped AK, kind of in the reminiscent of the late 1950s AKM. And, you know, you can easily see when you compare it to an AKM that, you know, they really had something there. Stoner and Sullivan, the designers, you know, Stoner really designed the AR-10 and Sullivan kind of miniature scaled it to the to the smaller intermediate cartridge. They had something there. They had it in weight. They had it in ergonomics. They really stumbled across or created something really unique and something that's really not out of place today. I was looking at that saying, of what possible use could this be today, other than as what Brownells has intended, a nostalgia, fun, educational piece that would be, you know, a great addition to an AR collection or for somebody who's interested in the history of weapons and development of weapons. What really would this thing be good for today? And the answer is the lightweight, slim profile, very quick handling of this rifle would make it a great raid rifle. I mean, if you were doing daylight raids and did not need night vision device on it or optics, it's outstanding. I mean, it is streamlined. It is very, very quick handling. It fires, you know, it's the usual. It's got the M16A1 AR-15 performance of 1 in 12 twist, 55 grain, and we'll talk a little more about that later. Great rifle to use, especially if you're moving fast, hitting a target and then moving out. It is outstanding. And you know, that fixed A1 style buttstock, the D buttstock, you know, it fits a lot of people just right. I'm one of those people. It fits just right. And everything about the rifle feels good. It's got a good trigger pull. It's got a lot of things going for it. And it would still be a viable rifle today. for a lot of purposes. Is it as modular? No. Can you hang all the accessories on it? No. But it would be very good today. You cannot even hang a bayonet on it. It does not have a bayonet lug. But when it comes to lightweight firepower in a very, very streamlined and sleek package, it still got it. And I can see why it was very, very impressive in 1958, 1959. A couple of things the article gets wrong. It talks about the charging handle being frail. It's not. I would say that it's no more frail than the T-handle. I mean, they're aluminum, basically aluminum parts, and they're designed to pull the bolt back. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. So I wouldn't necessarily call it frail. I would also say that the top slot that is the slot that's in the top of the upper receiver so that the charging handle can slide back and forth. Because of the way that's made, that's not a problem. It's not going to allow debris and dirt get in there. You don't have to run the charging handle when you change magazines. If you run dry, you just simply insert a new magazine, hit the bolt release, and you're back in business, just like with any other AR. So it's not really something when it is open, when that charging handle is at the rear, so what? You just push it back forward and it's good. The bolt stays open. It's not a problem, not an issue. So I don't even know why you'd mention that. The other thing that was mentioned was it's a slick side receiver and it doesn't have all the protective fencing. Which I don't really am not a real fan of anyway. It just added weight to something that just didn't need to be there. You know, is it nice to have a kind of a raised ridge around your magazine release? I suppose so. And I suppose someone can always point out, well, you know, that prevents the magazine from being accidentally dropped. I completely get all that. Other rifles don't have it. There are other rifles that do not have it or do not have the any kind of protection around it. So if you got snagged, you can drop an FNFAO mag or partially disengage it. Same thing with the G3. They've got the paddle release and they have the button release, and the button is not protected by anything. So I see those as kind of non-issues. So all in all, I think that the article was good. It was informative. It would certainly make you want to buy one, which is what articles in these publications are supposed to do. This is a form of infomercial advertising, not necessarily an objective, hardcore review. But I think that all in all, the Brownell's gun is fine. One of the things that I really like about it is there are two details that I really like. One is they put in, they have the early style front sight post, even to the point where it has the hole in the front. And most people don't know that hole in the front was so that you could use the older style gas tube. It helped install the older style gas tube. So most people don't know that, but that was a touch. They could have easily left that off and no one would be the wiser. Nobody would know. The other thing they put on is the duckbill flash suppressor, which I think not only does a great job, but it definitely has a look to it that I really like, and it definitely helps set the rifle off as something very, very unique and very, very different. So they've done an outstanding job with it. The fit and finish are just excellent. They're just excellent. If you ever bought brand new Colt SP1s, you could get an upper and a lower that had slightly different colorations to them. You know, same thing with M16s before they went to the black, when they were in the kind of that gray-green Parkerized. But this one is very solid and really nice. Same tone. All the parts are finished, and even the steel parts, which are Parkerized, they got that matching exceptionally well also. So it's really a beautiful job they did on it. Beautiful job. Am I a huge fan of the handguards? Well, they they kind of look cheesy. You do have that seam that goes down the side. Sometimes you just have to accept it. It is what it is. And if they could have manipulated or put some kind of finish on top of the material to make it look a little more like the older, 1950s fiberglass, that would have been nice. But again, you're going to pay for that. And if you're willing to pay for it, you can get it. And that's something you could possibly do aftermarket. But I would like the handguards to be a little stiffer and have them match up, mate a little bit better. But that's really getting picky because I really, really like the rifle. So I'm willing to accept that small, very small concession to having it. For most people, this is the only chance you'll ever have to get one. Outside of going on a custom basis and spending big dollars, I'm talking $3,000 to $4,000, this is the game in town that is at a price point that most people can definitely appreciate. Okay, while we're at it, I kind of decided that the Q&A this time would focus on AR-15 M16 myths. And the reason I did that was you still hear these things. They're still printed in some of the goofy forums and things like this. It's just amazing. I came from an era where the 30 caliber rifle was the rifle. And there were a lot of people who were when I joined the service, there were a lot of people there who had used, now they were very senior, both as NCOs and officers, but they had trained with the M1, and they were M1 guys. They became M14 guys, and then grudgingly were issued M16s. And while most of them did not say anything negative about it, and a few said some very, very positive things, there was a horrific public perception that the M16 was a piece of junk, that it didn't work, it jammed all the time, got people killed. It was just something that, again, it was kind of that skepticism of why trust government, look what they'll do to you if they get a chance. And I never quite understood that. I thought, well, if something doesn't work, we usually get rid of it. I mean, we get rid of it. We'll take it and find something new and replace it. We did that with, tanks, airplanes. When something became obsolete or it didn't live up to expectations, it was quickly replaced. So why would we not do that with an infantry rifle? And the real answer was because there was no need to, because it was a fine infantry rifle. By the time I got into uniform, the M16A1 was well established, and it had amassed a great combat record in Southeast Asia. I mean, all you ever hear about is, well, the earlier ones, they didn't have cleaning kits, and they were jammed, and there were guys with, cleaning rods taped to the deal and all that. That was pretty isolated. For the most part, the rifle adapted very, very well. And yes, they did have to, fumble around logistically and get patches and kits out to the field. And they came out with, CLP and LSA to basically lubricate the weapons better than just straight oil. So, it did require a little bit of an adjustment, but it performed brilliantly. And man, I can tell you, if you've ever been an infantryman or have ever done, a long rucksack march where you're carrying, no shit equipment, you're carrying the real shit, not just, the mandatory junk that people will have you put in a rucksack. But if you're carrying that and every pound counts and you come to appreciate an M16 vis-a-vis an M14 or an M1 or an AK-47, which is also a heavy gun. The magazines are heavy and all that. You come to appreciate lightweight, good equipment. Now, people would not appreciate it if it didn't perform. On ranges, I saw the M16 really perform very, very well. It is just very, very well. The few problems you have with it are usually magazine related, and that's because there were a lot of old magazines in the inventory. And, you know, or I should say not really old magazines, because the age doesn't really matter. It's, is the magazine damaged? And aluminum magazines can get damaged. That's just the way it goes. The Soviets saw their way around that. They basically used heavy metal magazines and then went to plastic magazines, which, you know, I'm not sure that a plastic magazine is a great idea. I'd much rather probably go with aluminum than plastic. But anyway, it performed very, very well. And so I think that there are a lot of the myths you still hear today are just garbage, and we'll just go down. One of them is they jam all the time, and we just kind of talked about that. The only time I've ever seen an M16 really kind of be a jam-o-matic is when you're out on maneuvers and you're shooting blanks, and you know those blanks are loaded with some nasty kind of powder, and they're really just designed to produce enough gas to cycle the action and chamber the next blank, and they will coat the inside of the barrel with some of the nastiest stuff there is. Cleaning a rifle after it's been shooting blanks is hideous, and that's why troops will complain about cleaning an M16. After a range, it's not nearly as bad, where you're firing live rounds at targets at a qualification. It's not nearly as bad as when you're, coming back from, you know, the what they used to call RTEPs, which were the Army training programs, or you're doing lane training, or any place where you're shooting any kind of quantity of blanks through the rifle. So they really don't jam. And you really can't hold blanks as a or damaged magazines against the rifle itself. Those are different problems. Another completely specious piece of information was the 5.56 and 2.23 are weak, and you saw this repeated in gun magazines over and over and over again, derisively called poodle shooters, and this was by a lot of the big gun guys in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s. I mean, those guys were 30 caliber, big bullet guys, whether it was handguns or rifles, and they were not impressed with the small caliber, high velocity. They didn't believe in it. They just didn't believe in it, so they weren't going to write anything complimentary towards it. You know, to them, it was akin to shooting a 22 Magnum. They couldn't figure out why that was good. And they couldn't figure out things like, you know, there was some basic logic to what they were saying. If 5.56 is so good, then why can't we hunt deer with it? If they won't let you shoot a 110-pound whitetail with it, why would you try to shoot a 150 or 200-pound man with it? You know, where is the logic there? And of course, that just happened to be an anachronism with game laws and some of the problems that those don't catch up as quickly as they do, and in some places now you can hunt with a 5.56, but there's not a weak cartridge out to 300 yards. A single 5.56 round, the ball 193 will go through, will put down a target. So that's just, again, something untrue. Another thing that always dogged the AR-15 M16 until recent times, and especially does it when you're really talking about the A1 series, was that, hey, it's inaccurate. And the proof, quote-unquote, of this was that it never seemed to do as well in rifle competitions as would an M14 or an M1. And part of that was those rifles were in some ways designed to perform well on courses like the National Match Course, given how their sights worked and how they were easy to adjust. The A1 sights weren't quite as easy to adjust. You had to adjust the front sight, which, you know, Americans, we'd never had a service rifle like that. And then you did the windage on the rear sight, and you really kind of needed either a bullet tip or a tool to do that. You didn't really have knobs until later, until the M16A2. So, you know, it was considered a little more problematic. Also, if you got into a tight sling position, your point of impact probably did change, because now you're introducing a new stress onto the system, where, as in the M1 and M14, you're kind of pulling at the bottom of the stock, and it's not really going to translate to pressure and stress on the barrel. So it's a different animal, and it was overcomeable. I mean, you can shoot very good scores with an M16A1, but most people defaulted to the earlier rifles and said, well, if they're better here, they've got to be better everywhere else. Another myth, and this comes out of, you see this on the internet all the time. Well, the AR-15/M16 has been continuously refined, and I suppose that goes to what you think refinements are. The basic, you take the gun like the Brownells AR Proto, and you have an excellent weapon as it stands. Now, if you call a refinement, well, we can now mount optics on it. That's fair enough. Or we put fences around the buttons. I suppose that's fair enough. I don't think they're that useful. Or we've created these new handguard systems where, you know, rail systems where we can hang all this other junk off it. I suppose that's fine too. But the basic mechanism has not really been changed. The basic mechanism, you know, the bolts, you get an early AR-15 bolt, and it'll go into a modern rifle. And you probably don't even have to headspace it. The rifle seems to not be very, it seems to be very forgiving in that manner, that it really doesn't need to be headspaced as you would think for a traditional rifle. Kind of the way it locks in there is really pretty good, and I've seen a lot of bolts get interchanged, and even though it's not a good practice, it happens all the time. And the thing of it is that the guns still shoot, and they shoot accurately and very, very well. So the fact that, and that's going back to the earliest form of the rifle. So you can't really say that the mechanism itself has been refined. They really haven't done anything to the triggers. You can buy aftermarket stuff, and there's a lot of aftermarket support. But, you know, just the off-the-shelf guns are the off-the-shelf guns, and there really hasn't been a whole lot. In 60 years, there have not been a lot of improvements. And so I would say that you know, that's really a myth too, that it's just been continually tweaked to make it better. I think it's been changed to suit different requirements, and it is flexible, a very flexible and agile design that can be adapted to whatever new requirements emerge. Now, if you want to call that continually refining it, I suppose so. I consider that adapting what is a fantastic design to the changing requirements that people face. One of my favorite ones is that they were made by Mattel. No, the M16s, no version of the M16 was ever made by Mattel, other than they did make a toy copy. They never made the rifle. They never made the handguards or any of the furniture. There's all these myths that, well, I saw one that said Mattel on it. And you know, it's just simply not true. And it kind of goes back to the last podcast where I said, well, I like it when somebody has a DD-214, a discharge paper proving they served, because I think they might have a great perspective on how something works and how good this would be in a military setting. But just because they have a DD-214 doesn't mean everything they say is gospel truth. So definitely understand there was never a Mattel version of the M16 in U.S. government use. And kind of going on with that is that it was easy to bend the barrel, and it's not. No barrel is easy to bend. The only barrels I've ever seen that are bent are ones that they wanted to deliberately crunch and destroy. Yes, you can bend them that way. But then when you look at some of the like World War I and World War II battlefield dig-ups, I guess it was artillery or something, but yeah, they can pull up some of those relic dug-up rifles and submachine guns that the barrels are wickedly bent on those. I don't know what causes that. It's hard for me to think anything other than a blast would do that. But and in fact, the barrel bending myth was so big that we actually had to perform tests on M16A1s occasionally. And what you do is take a section of cleaning rod and drop it gingerly down the barrel to see if it would bind anywhere, meaning that the barrel was bent and it couldn't pass through. Never saw one that was bent, so don't know, even know if that was a very good test. It was probably a colossal waste of time. Another one that comes up is that the bullet tumbles in the air. Okay, the bullet does not tumble in the air, end over end tumble. The bullet spins very, very fast. It's a very fast bullet. Comes out at about anywhere between 3,000 and 3,200 feet per second. And very, very fast. And very, very flat shooting. And very, very accurate. But it's spinning at a very, very high rate. That's why we have rifling in there. If the minute the bullet left the bore, it started tumbling end over end, you wouldn't need rifling. Why would you try to spin it if the intended action is to have it tumble end over end? This was done by people who didn't understand ballistics, and somehow it became myth. I first saw it in a James Fallows book called National Defense, I think is what it was called. And it basically said, yes, you know, the M16, it tumbles end over end, creates horrific wounds. All not true. Now, when a bullet goes from the air into another medium, such as a person or some kind of a obstacle, like a light wall or something, whatever the bullet hits, that can change the bullet from spinning and drilling a hole into where it will become unstable and go end over end or cavitate wildly, do things like that. So it's all about the medium, the change of medium from air to whatever it hits. That's what causes the bullet. Which brings us to our next myth, which is the bullet was designed to wound and not kill. Okay, that's complete trash, complete garbage. It is an incredibly lethal round. And in fact, in Southeast Asia, it was, you know, the truth of the matter is it's a more lethal round than 7.62 by 39. It just is. You can get hit by that. That's a relatively stable bullet. And it's at a lot lower velocity. You don't have the hydrostatic shock, and the bullet doesn't tend to upset in the new medium, meaning a person, nearly as much as a 5.56 Ball 193 will. Now, what you'll find is when they decided to improve, and this is always dangerous when somebody tries to improve something that's already good, when they tried to improve it and they came out with the M855 round, which has the steel penetrator and is 62 grains and all these other good things, and it could penetrate a helmet at 500 yards, that probably is a much more stable bullet. And so it the rap on it is it doesn't upset and tumble in the new medium, meaning a person, that it would hit. It would tend to drill more of a hole, stay more stable. It really doesn't matter because they're both very lethal rounds. So I would say that's probably pretty much a draw, but that criticism is out there that somehow the M855 round was overstabilized, and that was considered a bad thing because it wasn't as damaging. But it was never designed to wound and not kill. It was never designed specifically to create a wound and not be lethal. That's ludicrous. You know, that goes with the old myth of, well, you can't shoot a 50 caliber at enemy troops in the open, only against vehicles and aircraft, according to the Geneva Convention. That's complete poppycock, complete trash. Yet, you know, these things just circulated for years. These kind of things circulate for years. And I think in the internet era, they're a lot easier to kind of kill, because somebody puts out on a forum and somebody else will call bullshit on it, call BS, and say, no, this is not the case. But these things for decades moved around and around. And the other myth to get on is that GI magazines are junk, and only the Magpul and some of these other, I guess there's some other ones out there, only those are really good and really reliable and worth staking your life on. Well, I can tell you, you know, if that makes you feel better and it's authorized to do it, you fully can do that. But I will also say that I found the GI magazines to be excellent. And I said this in an earlier podcast, the best magazine for an AR-15 M16 is one that's clean, undamaged, and maintained. And I have some that have to be 50 or 60 years old that fall into that category. I mean, I got some 20 rounders that are so freaking old, they got the steel followers in them. You know, I mean, that has to be Vietnam era, has to be. And you see these things for sale occasionally. They'll say, Vietnam era magazine, metal follower. And, you know, I'm sure if you go to gun shows, you can find these. Then there was the black follower and the green follower. And even then people came up with like an OD green anti-tilt follower. Now, I never had a problem with those. Now, maybe I'm just not very high speed, but I took care of my magazines and my ammo. And I'll just tell you, the regimen I did was weekly. Every magazine I had, I unloaded it, I inspected it, I checked the spring tension, I made sure it was clean. I'm not really big on taking them apart all the time unless I need to, and I also protected them. I made sure that, you know, when they were in pouches, they were in pouches, they were protected. They weren't just, you know, lying around in the bottom of a Hummer, you know, collecting all the sand and grit and junk that would fall around. So I rigorously inspected them. I would reload them, make sure that everything was in there. You know, when I had time at night and I wasn't doing anything else, I would be reloading my magazines, making sure they were straight. And I made darn sure that they were clean and functional. And so, you know, I've got magazines that are decades and decades old, and they still seem to work. So I would not say GI mags are junk. I think they're one of the best, the very best buys out there. I mean, you can find them, you know, to get a rifle magazine for $7 or $8 is really good. And if you want to buy the Magpul ones, or Pro Mag, whatever they call them, I've actually bought two of them just to test and see what they're like, and they're nice. I mean, they're okay. My only criticism of those are they don't like to, when I'm doing a speed reload, like run the gun dry or simulate a malfunction and want to put something in there or do a tactical reload where I want to take out a magazine that may have 3 rounds in it and put in a fresh one. They don't seem to want to fall out of the magwell as well as, you know, I can't swipe them out quite as efficiently, but that's a small thing. And that may just be me. So, but all in all, I think they're a good product. And they're certainly nice and robust. That's one thing I do like about them, is that they're made out of, you know, some sort of polymer, and they're thick, and I believe that they're metal reinforced, so they're not cheesy or cheap. The magazines I would stay away from are, there were old thermaled magazines out there on the market, and before the bans, there have been some cheap civilian mags out there. So I would kind of be very wary of those. But I would I'd say anything made by a reputable manufacturer or anything that's USGI. And if you have a question on a USGI mag, just go ahead and Google the manufacturer name on the bottom, and that'll tell you. The only ones I know of that were bad were called Cooper Industries, and they actually lost a contract. Now it was way back in the 80s, and I remember we had to go through our arms room, and anything with that had a Cooper base plate got taken out and crunched. I understand it was because they didn't put enough welds on them and whatever that is. So if you have a Cooper magazine and it works fine for you, you can flip your coin and take your chance on that. But we had to get rid of them. So I have magazines that I've found out in maneuver areas and been sitting there for at least months, if not longer. And you know, you can bring them back to life. You bring them in, you clean them up, and I never found one with a bad spring. That was a part that amazed me, is after picking up, I'm sure I picked up 10 or 15 of those over the years. Not a huge number, but I would pick those up, and never found one that had a spring that ever was bad or let loose. Every one I just cleaned up. The only thing that would really take it out is if you have a bad dent in the magazine body, then you know you're pretty much finished. It's just, number one, it's not worth trying to fix it, and number two, I don't know that you can ever get the dent out of it completely enough that you'll feel good about it. It's usually best just to scrap that and move on. But usually those are ones that have been run over, and they're usually completely crunched. So that's the litany on the magazines. They are an interesting part of the gun. I do enjoy having some of the, you know, finding some of the more rare military contract names. I have one from Sanchez Enterprises, and I Googled them, and they had a contract for a while, and a long time ago, probably 30 years ago, and they produced M16 magazines, and so it's a good deal. But you can still find great deals on lightly used and even brand new, still in the box, GI magazines, and that's the way I would go. Definitely, that's the way I would go. Now you're probably asking the question, well, if the AR-15/M16 is so good, why doesn't just everybody use it? And why isn't the AK-47 just hanging in museums and or in old storage stockpiles, never to see the light of day again? And the answer to that is kind of interesting, is that everyone who can and can afford it and politically can make it happen transitions from AKs to M16s and M4s. When I say M16, I mean the whole M4 family. Anybody who can does. And you'll find that even the special operations units of a lot of different countries, their service rifle might be one thing, but their special operations guys are using M4s, especially now. And I mean that to include the HK416 as well. That's really just, okay, it's a piston-driven AR. Okay, I get it. There's some internal parts in the handguard there that are going to be different. And from what I understand, it really only makes a difference in full auto fire, that maybe it's a benefit there. But for the commercial user and actually the average troop, the average soldier, which actually does not fire fully automatic very much, it probably doesn't mean a darn bit of difference. So everybody who can is. And I mean, it's become a world standard. In contrast, as I was speaking earlier, from the days when everybody thought the AK-47 was a super weapon and we had some, you know, Mattel-made piece of junk, it's turned out to be not the case at all, almost 180 degrees different. We have a brilliantly designed weapon that uses some of the most advanced materials. So, and it's so good that even an example built on the pattern that was used in 1958 is still a very awesome weapon today. That doesn't happen very often. That doesn't happen at all. And all I can say is you put the Brownells right beside an AKM clone, and you'll see the difference, and you'll be very favorably impressed. Very favorably impressed. But yes, a lot of armies would much prefer to have M16s than AKs. So it's going to be a very, very interesting future to see where this all goes, to see if the AR still continues to displace the AK, or if there's something new or a game changer which is unknown to us at this point. Well, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns. We are on Podbean, and we're also on YouTube, and we're maybe have some interesting news in the future. A couple of firearms networks might be interested in us. We'll see. And when that happens, we'll be sure to let you know where we are and where you can continue to leave your comments, and if there's any new places. You can always leave a comment on Podbean, and you can always leave one on YouTube in the comments. I read those. I will definitely bring your questions or your comments to light in the next podcast. And we look forward from hearing from you. As always, please hit the follower button, and that way you'll get an alert when the next episode posts. But for right now, this is Old School Guns out.